Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We'll hear oral argument first in the case of Lewis against Anderson. Ms. Bodie.
May it please the court. I am Lynn Bodie, counsel for the appellant. This case is on appeal from the Western District of Wisconsin, where the district court granted defendant's motion for summary judgment. The appellants, five boys, assert that the social workers deprived them of their 14th Amendment substantive due process rights when they placed the boys with Derwin and Rebecca Lewis, who then abused the boys. In granting summary judgment, the district court improperly resolved issues of fact and chose among inferences. Summary judgment should be reversed and the case remanded for trial. The boys became wards of the state of Wisconsin on May 31, 1990. They had a constitutional right to a safe and secure placement, and the social workers had an affirmative duty to protect the boys. Social worker Lancour had responsibility for the boys until July 31, 1990, although social worker Stolle was also involved in finding the boys a home. After July 31, Stolle had primary responsibility. Social worker Bali supervised and consulted with both Lancour and Stolle during this entire time. The social workers placed the boys in foster care with the Lewises, beginning in June and July of 1990. They were in foster care until April 23, 1991, when the Lewises adopted them. The social workers were...
Is it possible to have damages after the period of adoption, given the Rooker-Feldman doctrine?
Well, Your Honor, social workers in this case were instrumental in making sure that the boys were adopted, and they made misrepresentations to the adoption court.
But nonetheless, custody was under the order of the court, and given the Rooker-Feldman doctrine, you can't get damages for things that flow from a court order.
Your Honor, in this case, the children would not have been placed in foster care at all with the Lewises and therefore could not have been adopted by them. This issue has arisen in this case and I believe was addressed in the brief, and I'd be happy to provide a post-argument brief addressing that concern more specifically.
I didn't see a discussion of the Rooker-Feldman doctrine in the brief.
Well, Your Honor, and it could be that it was in the briefs in the court below. I could be mistaken, but I thought it was actually addressed.
I don't remember it here either, but...
It was addressed in the court below, and it was not found to be a basis to dismiss, as I recall, but I really would be happy to address that legal question.
Yes, I think it would be prudent for both sides to file memoranda within 10 days, should be possible, since it was discussed in the district court, addressing the significance for this case of the Rooker-Feldman doctrine.
Absolutely, we would be happy to do so.
Thank you.
I wonder if you could speak a little bit about the KH decision, because mm-hmm. I have to say on the issues that you were briefing here, it seems to me that however you dressed it up, the principal concern that you had was that there were red flags in front of these social workers that they didn't follow up on, such as the Nelson's recommendation, you know, or form that they filled out, recommendation or not, as the case may be. But I looked at those forms, and I really didn't see anything, especially with respect to the Nelsons, who said they recommended this person, this couple, the Lewises, as adoptive parents. I saw nothing that met the standard that was established in our KH case, and I wonder if we could at least address that before we move on to the question whether you think this court should reconsider KH.
Sure. The facts before the court with respect to the KH standard? Mm-hmm. Okay. There was actually a constellation of facts. The Nelson reference was clearly, in our opinion, a red flag. And
but I don't see, that's not what KH is talking about. So if all we have is a Nelson reference, I don't see where that's either actual knowledge that these people would be unsatisfactory custodians for the children for a period of time, or even suspicion when the Nelsons say they recommend them.
The Nelson reference says we have concerns about adding more children to the home because the home is unstable, especially concerns about older children.
But is that a suspicion that they're actually bad, or is the Nelson simply pointing out for the social workers a fact that, frankly, anyone who adds six children or five children, I thought three was a lot, but, you know, that's a lot of kids. And so it doesn't seem to me the social workers would have been shocked to read this as something the Nelson.
Well, it is a lot of kids. And, in fact, an expert previous to them, Kathy Mitchell, had said, don't even put six of these kids together because their needs are so extraordinary, they're going to overwhelm any parent, any foster parent. So then they take the six kids anyway, decide to put them together, not just together, but add them to five more kids, three of whom have special needs themselves, to create 9 out of 11 with special needs. Then they get the Nelson reference saying, even with five kids, these people are too unstable right now, and you shouldn't add more older children. Then,
But that's the difficulty of reading that recommendation as saying you shouldn't add more children when their bottom line is these are fine parents and we are enthusiastic about recommending them.
What they said at the very end of the reference, it said, would you place a child with these people? And they said yes. Now, a child was one child, and I think that they felt they were doing okay with the first.
But then what you're saying is that anybody who's worried about adding six children to a household must be worried about physical abuse.
No.
If you want to know whether this is a tip-off of a worry about physical abuse, you would ask even for one child. But the Nelson recommendation was favorable on that subject.
Then what we had, actually there's evidence in the record from our expert that says, given that particular recommendation and knowing how references are used in placing children, that should have been followed up on.
But that's exactly what KH precludes as a standard for liability, I think. You need to be beyond that. You should have gone further. I'm not prepared to sit here and say that those social workers shouldn't have gone further, but I don't see that that's the relevant standard.
You're correct. And actually what our expert said was they didn't even achieve the minimal level of acceptable professional judgment. Then, a few months later, the social workers knew that Derwin hit a child, and he admitted he lost it. He hit a child because he got angry and he lost his temper. The facts piled upon themselves. The other thing that we have in this case that we know, or at least there's evidence in the record that supports this, is the social workers put the boys in the home and they left. They never talked to the boys alone again. They dispute this, and I understand that. But there is evidence in the record from which a jury could conclude that they did not meet with the boys alone again in a safe environment or even alone, period.
What's the evidence from which a jury can conclude that they never met with the kids in the absence of the Lewises?
The boys have submitted affidavits which are in the record which say that. Max Lewis, the oldest boy who was 10 when he was placed, in his affidavit indicated that he tried to meet with them alone.
I want to have ice cream with you.
There were a couple
of things. But that's different. The question I asked is, what's the evidence from which a jury could conclude that they never met with the kids in the absence of the Lewises?
The boys' affidavits say that. They never met with the social workers alone.
No. Let's try again.
Okay.
Met with the social workers in the absence of the Lewises. I'm not asking whether a given child met alone with the social workers. I'm asking whether the kids got to talk to the social workers without the Lewises being there.
Right, and I perhaps misphrased what they said in their affidavits, but that is in fact what they testified, that they didn't meet with them without the Lewises there. So what we have is, we have in the very beginning Kathy Mitchell saying, don't put all these kids together. We have a reference which raises, according
but
to...
But yes. The problem here, this is an extraordinarily difficult placement, I would think.
Mm-hmm.
Six children, most with special needs, and they're Indian, and there's this statute that requires a placement with a parent who's Indian, apparently. I would think the universe of people willing to adopt or take in as foster children in that situation is really limited, isn't it?
Well, we don't know. We know that they
did. Well, you know here that they were the only ones left standing at the end. There was only one other family that was even interested here.
That
they dropped out.
What the statute requires, though, is not, it's not a blanket requirement that the children be placed in an Indian home.
Well,
so if there's not...
It is absent good cause.
Yes.
What does good cause mean?
Well, good cause can mean that the children's physical, psychological, and emotional needs can't be met by any available Indian home placement. And
if there had been a showing that the Lewises had repeatedly been before the state court for on charges of child abuse, then obviously it seems to me that the social workers would have satisfied the good cause requirement and could have found a non-Native American family, right? But that's not this case. This is a case where at most there's this one incident of hitting which gets resolved to everyone's satisfaction, as I understand from the briefs.
Actually, there's nothing in the record that the hitting was resolved to anybody's satisfaction. According to the record, nothing happened. After Derwin admitted to Sandy Stolle that he hit this child, there was no resolution. Your Honor, I notice my white light is on. I'd be happy to answer more questions, however, or to continue.
Well, that's your rebuttal time.
Yes, I know. I'd like to preserve rebuttal.
Certainly, Ms. Bode.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
May it please the court, my name is Mary Bath. I'm an assistant attorney general. I represent the defendant social workers in this action. And with me at council table this morning is Therese Durkin, legal counsel for the State Department of Health and Family Services. In this case, the district court properly granted the social worker's motion for summary judgment. It is undisputed that our social workers did not know, nor did they suspect any abuse. There is no genuine issue of any material fact here because there's nothing outcome determinative. There is nothing that this court could look to say that a reasonable jury would have found differently if this case were tried tomorrow.
Ms. Bat, I'm wondering, by analogy to the Eighth Amendment prison medical cases or something like that, where we typically say something like ordinary medical malpractice isn't enough to show a claim under the Eighth Amendment, but there are some things that a doctor might do, like just walking past somebody who's having seizures on the floor or, you know, day after day seeing someone with an obvious broken leg or something. There are some things that a doctor could do that are both professionally irresponsible and an Eighth Amendment violation. And it would seem to me, given the Supreme Court's drawing of these kinds of analogies in Youngberg, that the same thing must be true in this situation as well, that when you're within the boundaries of professional judgment, that's all right, and even if you exceed those boundaries to the point of negligence, you still have not transgressed these due process rights. But there's got to be a point where it's simply so egregious that the due process rights are violated. I don't know if they put 50 such special needs children in the home of the Lewises, or I don't know where it is, but it seems to me we're in a line drawing exercise here, just as we are in the prison cases. And just to say, well, they thought everything was fine may not be enough.
That's correct. I think that this court's decision in KH addresses that situation because KH allows for the knows or suspects standard. KH cited to Daniels, which was a prisoner case, and that dealt with deliberate indifference. And I believe if the court looks at the cases that come up under the deliberate indifference standard, there's one example in particular, and I cannot recall which case it comes from, but they talk about if prison officials know that there might be a riot because something has happened in the past, and knowledge comes to them that something may be occurring, and they walk by and they hear things, something like that adds up where it definitely could be point, you know, where they say the risk is so obvious that they nevertheless are going to infer that they knew. Those type of situations, I believe, are covered under the KH standard of knows or suspects.
So you would agree that, at least in very broad brush terms, just as we do for the Eighth Amendment or others, we have both an objective and a subjective component that we need to look at. Objectively, something seriously wrong has to be going on, but subjectively, under KH, knowledge is certainly enough for subjectively or suspects to know. And then the question becomes, well, at what point could a jury infer that these people suspected? They're not going to stand up there in their deposition and say, yeah, I suspected that the Lewises were child abusers. They're going to say no. But how does one get at the suspects to be part of the standard?
Well, unfortunately, the court in KH did not define what suspects mean. It did define what knows means. And knows is a known propensity to neglect.
But we're now faced with suspects to be. That really does seem to be the basis of your opponent's theory.
Well, it's our position that there is no basis either for known or suspect, but I think you're correct. There is definitely nothing in the record to indicate that our social workers knew of any abuse. That clearly is the case.
But can you give us some help then on suspects to be? They're saying that by the time there's this somewhat strangely worded document from the Nelsons, and they know about at least one incident of physical hitting, which actually is not even permitted in schools in most states of the United States, maybe in all states of the United States, I don't know, but it's certainly frowned upon. These are some pretty serious red flags where you might begin to suspect that somebody does abuse children. When do you get a jury on that question?
Well, I would refer this case to the Yvonne L. out of New Mexico, 10th Circuit. And that case was cited in, I believe, Camp versus Gregory, one of the other cases that this court decided. And in that case, Yvonne L. talked about actual knowledge of abuse or that agency personnel deliberately failed to learn what was occurring in the home. That's one standard that the court has looked at.
Your opponent seems to think there's contested evidence in this record about the efforts these social workers made during the period of the foster care to find out what was happening in the home. Can you tell us what evidence is there about that question?
In the appendix to our brief, we cited to the dispositional hearing that was held on May 31st, 1990. That was when the children were placed in the Lewis home. And at that dispositional hearing, one of our defendants, April Lancor, was a social worker working with the children for placement. And at that hearing, there was indication they talked about the boys' pre-placement visits with the Lewises, where Ms. Lancor had driven them to the placements, and there's evidence in the record that other social workers who are defendants here took them back. There's absolutely nothing in the record to indicate that during those visits, pre-placement visits with the Lewises, that any of these boys said anything, nor did our social workers look or see anything that would be typical indicia of abuse. For example, what would lead a social worker to suspect abuse?
Now, of course, the boys would be unlikely to say something if all the interviews were conducted in the presence of the Lewises. What does the record show about whether the social workers met with the kids outside the presence of the Lewises?
We have affidavits from our social workers, and it's also in the dispositional hearing that there were these visits where they were alone with the boys. They were driving them back and forth from the visit.
And in your view, is this a contested issue?
Apparently. At least it's apparently.
What do you mean apparently?
Well, I believe they are.
You know the record better than I. What does the record show? Is this contested in the record?
Lynn Bodie is contesting that during the
I'm not interested in what Ms. Bodie is contesting. I'm interested in what's in the record. What's in the record?
What is in the record from our social workers is that they
I'm
met...
Look, there are two sides to this case. I know what your side says. What does the record show about affidavits from the other side?
The affidavits from the boys indicate that they state that they were never alone with the social workers at all during the placement period.
And, but what do you understand the word alone to mean?
where they could talk with them alone outside of the presence of the Lewises.
All right. So in your view, this is indeed a contested issue.
That's correct. We have evidence in the record from our social workers that they met alone with the boys in the basement of the home on numerous occasions.
Now, your brief says this is an uncontested issue.
I believe our brief says it is not a material fact. I don't believe this is outcome determinative. There was a telephone in the home. These boys were at school.
These are children, Ms. Beth. I mean, I'm worried about the idea that the law says that unless children who are, let's hypothesize to get away from the facts of this case, children who are being abused. And you're saying that children have the obligation to pick up the phone and call the social work department? They can be intimidated. They can feel silent. Some people don't speak up for years later. That's why social workers have to make visits to the home. They've got to talk to teachers. They've got to find out this information without necessarily relying on potential victims of this kind of behavior.
That's correct. However, there are other things that social workers would typically look at to tip them off when they do these home visits. It's undisputed that there were home visits. Social workers were in the home.
Is there any physical sign of abuse?
Absolutely none. Nothing from school, nothing from church, nothing that our social workers noticed. There was no sexual acting out. There were no cuts. There were no bruises. There was no isolation. These children were active in the school. They were active in the community. They were in band. They took trips. They were active in sports activities. Nobody noticed any abuse. When these boys were placed with the Lewises on May 31st, the Indian Child social worker recommended the Lewises. Her name is Nancy Keene. The circuit court judge recommended the Lewises. April Lancor recommended the Lewises, and the county social worker recommended the Lewises. In fact, the boy's birth father, Edward Lipponen, recommended the Lewises. He gave up parental rights, knowing the Lewises were going to be adopting his children. He wanted them in the Lewis home. They had agreed to allow him visitation. Everybody thought this was a great placement. Not only did they think this was a good placement, they thought they were doing a great job keeping this family of six reunited in a Native American home where they could maintain tribal integrity and not lose the family bond. Nothing indicates our social workers ever knew or suspected abuse.
Of course, eventually the kids are removed from the Lewis home, right?
Eventually they left the Lewis home and then the county removed them. I will say that with respect to the whether or not there is indication in the record as to whether or not there was any injuries, I can tell this court that there is in the record sealed the county investigation. That record fully supports the social workers, and I encourage the court to look at it, because what this court is going to find, there were no injuries. There was nothing whatsoever that happened to that boy that would meet the statutory definition of abuse in this case. No physical injuries. There is no way a jury acting reasonably could conclude there is abuse. The boys say that if you add all of these things together, add the reference letters, add this incident, add the Nelson letter, add it all up together, and they say you get abuse. I suggest otherwise. You add it up together, and you get nothing. Zero plus zero equals zero. Everybody thought this was a great placement. The county thought it was a great placement. The Indian Child social worker thought it was a great placement. The judge thought it was a great placement. And the boy's birth father thought that this was a great placement. All the boys have done with this case is alleged negligence. Our social workers did not do a good home study, did not do the follow-up, did not check out the references. That is nothing more than negligence. And in the lower court, this case was argued strictly under a negligence theory, that somehow negligence or gross negligence could support a 1983 action. That's how this case came up through the district court. There's absolutely nothing in the record to indicate that our social workers knew of any abuse or suspected any abuse. Rebecca did not come from a dysfunctional family. She came from a family that was separated. She had strong religious beliefs. She described herself as honest, creative, teaching. She had membership in community organizations. She grew up with her grandmother. She attended mission school. She graduated from high school. She attended college. There's absolutely nothing outcome determinative in their allegations about Rebecca that would lead a social worker to know or suspect abuse, nor could a reasonable jury infer knowledge or suspicion of abuse based on that. the Nelson reference letter, the bottom line is they recommended this family for placement. When asked, would you recommend these people to be adoptive parents, how did they answer? They answered yes. There is nothing outcome determinative in that answer that could cause a reasonable jury to suspect or know abuse. The number of kids to be adopted, 6 children. Granted, 6 children is a lot of children, but there is nothing in the record to support that simply because you've got a large family that those people are going to be abusive. Absolutely nothing. And indeed, even their expert does not connect up the number of children in the family to abuse. If the court looks at what their expert says, she alleges negligence on the part of our social workers, but she never connects up. She never makes a connection between what they failed to do and knowledge or suspicion of abuse. If this court looks at the record and looks at the testimony from the state's expert, all of the indicia, all of the indicators that a social worker would look at to know or suspect abuse simply are not there. These kids were in the Lewis home. They were thriving. They were going to school. They were going to church. They were active in community activities. They had telephones in the home. They took the school bus to school.
Does the record show what the nature of the special needs were, either of the Lewis kids or?
Under our statutory definition, basically anybody who is other than a white infant, a healthy white infant, would probably be special needs. Some of these kids were developmentally disabled. They did have various problems. I'm not offhand aware of what they were.
I just wondered.
My time is up. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ms. Batt. Anything further, Ms. Bodie?
Yes.
Thank you. I wanted to address the county investigation report that counsel referred to. That was discussed at some length in the briefs in this case and was stricken from the briefs. For that reason, we've not discussed it. In any event, Santa Sally owed a duty to the children in this case. Derwin hit another child in the home out of anger, losing his temper, not to avoid sparing the rod, not to spare the rod to avoid spoiling the child, but because he was angry, and we submit that this is a signal that he cannot control his anger and that something needed to be done in the minimal exercise of professional judgment to deal with that.
Do you agree that there's no signs of physical abuse that were apparent?
Well, kids that age get bumps and bruises all the time. I will agree that nobody reported abuse of these particular children, no teachers, for instance, during that time period. There is evidence in the record in the form of affidavits from the boys very specifically detailing some of the abuse, however, and that it, in fact, did occur. But again, the boys, like prisoners, were not required to report or alert the social workers to the abuse, although the record shows, again, that they tried, but they were not. The social workers didn't spend the time alone with them and didn't even react to their request to be alone with them. That would have enabled them to get that word out.
Tell me about that. They requested to be alone with the social worker? When was that made? And were the parents present, or the adopted parents present, Lewis's, when that request was made?
Max Lewis, the oldest boy, tried to be alone with the social worker, and he hung out outside the house when she had been in the house to try to catch her on the way out on 2 occasions. On one occasion, he caught her on the way to her car, and he said, "Please, will you take me for ice cream?" And she said, "Not now, maybe later." And the evidence in the record from Max is that she never came back. On another,
you're not saying that any of these children came to a social worker and said, "We have to see you alone."
No,
that
well,
they were supposed to be intuitive and infer that this child wanted to.
Yeah, and I would submit that in the exercise of minimal bona fide professional judgment, when a child asks specifically to be alone with a social worker whom he doesn't really know that well, that is something to react to.
Well, but one has to be very careful. You think the Constitution establishes the principle on pain of very substantial liability that every child who asks for ice cream is entitled to it?
No.
Looks like what you're arguing for. Any child who asks for ice cream is implicitly asking to be alone with a social worker. Any time a child asks to be alone with a social worker is constitutionally entitled to it, And so if you ask for ice cream and it's turned down, big damages follow.
No.
What else is missing in that case?
What I was responding to was the question of whether the children were, in fact, showing signs of abuse. And if that was the impression I gave, I was unclear, and I apologize. But this was simply to demonstrate that, in fact, the abuse was going on, and the record supports that.
But now the argument is any time a child asks for ice cream, that's evidence of physical abuse?
No.
Then I'm missing it. What's the evidence? I mean, Judge Evans asked whether there was any observable evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And you said, well, no, but the eldest child did ask for ice cream.
In this record, there's nothing in this record that says a teacher saw bruises on so-and-so, for instance. But there is evidence in the record, abundant evidence from the boys, where they specifically recall instances of being abused, both during and after the foster care period. And, in fact, they also recall during the foster care period, Okay, thank you. During the foster care period, trying to tell somebody about the abuse. It's not set forth to support the K-8 standard, but simply to demonstrate that, in fact, they were being abused during that period of time.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.